tonight. Dead batteries could bring new life. You're going to need a satellite to satellite that satellite. And Rob Boyd from TechWise TV comes on to geek out. Padres Corner is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Padres Corner is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and if you'd like to help us design our new website, I invite you to visit twit.to/navtest. We've got 8 quick questions we'd like to ask you that will help us make the navigation easier to use. That's twit.to/navtest. Thanks a lot.
This is Padres Corner, episode 16, recorded December 9th, 2014. TechWise with Rob Boyd. Welcome to Padres Corner. It's the place where we get to put you into the mind of a Jesuit priest and see if you come out sane on the other side. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, Padre SJ in the Twit TV chat room. Padres Corner is a place where we get to talk about the stories that have fallen through the cracks, things that are important for geeks and gals, folks like you from the Twit TV chat room. And as always, why don't we kick it off with some freaking science? This one is all about gadgets, about batteries. Now, we love our gadgets. If there's one thing that we've learned throughout the last couple of years, is that we are addicted to things that run on power. The world runs on batteries. We couldn't have our mobile revolution without them. Our phones, our laptops, our gizmos, our gadgets, even the data centers that run the servers and switches that make the internet possible, well, they all have a voracious appetite for batteries because they need power. Now, there are many people who don't remember a time before batteries were everywhere, a time where you expected to sometimes have no power because, well, the power would go out in your neighborhood, and I think those times are gone. Batteries have indeed changed the world in which we live. But the question is, what happens when your batteries start to die? I don't mean when they run out of charge, because we all know that we could recharge our batteries. I mean what happens when your batteries don't hold a charge, when they no longer give your gizmo, your gadget, your phone, your laptop, your whatever, the power that it needs. Well, we've all become very, very well accustomed with this. It's normally when you have to change out your iPhone or non-battery replaceable device, or it's when you have to find that new hard-to-find battery pack for a laptop that was made 7, 6, 5 years ago even. It's a phenomenon that happens because as batteries age, as they cycle through, as they recharge time and time again, they can no longer hold the same capacity that they did when they were brand new. And so we, being a gadget-conscious society, decide to replace them. But what happens to those batteries? We throw them away. They become our e-waste. They become a piece of refuse, a dangerous piece of refuse to the world. But maybe they don't have to. Some researchers for IBM took a look at the problem and realized that, well, these batteries aren't as useless as we think they are. These researchers looked at a sample of discarded batteries, and what they found was that more than 70% of them had enough remaining capacity to keep an LED light array powered for at least 4 hours every day. Now, not only that, but because lighting an LED is much less demanding than keeping a laptop or phone powered, these cells can last for years being power cycled each day. Now, power levels that would be useless for our mobile tech is actually perfect for bringing light to places where the power grid is less than dependable. So these researchers created something that they're calling the Urjar. I'm sure it has some sort of cool pronunciation. I'm not doing it. Essentially a box that combines some circuitry, a charging a gizmo, a couple of converters and boosters, along with some refurbished batteries. And what these Urjar chargers will allow you to do is to connect it to the main so that you can slurp power while you do have main power, and then convert that into usable electrical light or power for a mobile device. Now, this sounds simple. In fact, this idea has been tried before, but normally it's been tried with solar cells. And solar cells are far more expensive and far more logistically difficult to deploy. This is using an existing resource, which is an unstable power grid, in order to provide life-giving power. And trust me, power really does change the way that people live. When you can have light after the sun has gone down, when you can dependently charge your mobile devices, even though you don't have a power grid, when you can make sure that you can stay connected, even when you're living in squalor, it changes the way that you view the world. And who knows? Maybe our e-waste will become the light to those who live in darkness. Let's move away from e-waste and batteries and talk about something a little different, specifically the SKA, also known as the Square Kilometer Array. This little piece of science is being built right now in South America, and it's incredible. If you are into space exploration, if you're into radio telescopy, if you are into looking for intelligent life beyond the bounds of the Earth, this is something that you should be interested in. The SKA, when completed, will have a total collecting area of approximately 1 square kilometer. It will have receiving stations 3,000 kilometers from the central core. It will take measurements across a huge swath of radio frequencies, and it's designed to be 50 times more sensitive than any other radio instrument. It's going to utilize long-haul, low-latency links to research centers, which combined will have a greater capacity than that of the current combined global internet. Now, not only that, but it's going to survey the sky over 11,000 times faster than the past arrays, which means a lot more science, a lot more data, a lot more capability to look into the darkest, farthest recesses of the universe. It could be the single greatest tool in our observation of that known universe. It could change the way that we see ourselves and our place in the galaxy. It could be the tech that brings us together as we see the enormity of creation. But there's one little problem. You see, this SKA, this wonderful tool for peering into the unknowns of the universe, doesn't do cell phones, or FM radios, or CB radios, or AM radios, or Wi-Fi. 2G, 3G, 4G, forget about it. The problem with such a fantastic instrument, spread out over so much space, scanning so much of the radio spectrum, is that it does not deal well with radio interference. A cell phone tower would throw it off. An AM-FM station would throw it off. Wi-Fi would actually throw it off just because of the interference it generates on harmonic frequencies. This is a problem when you deal with such a large area. Remember, we've got some of these that are radiated out 3,000 kilometers. It's a huge, huge area, and there's people living in that region. So the question is, how do you get connectivity to people living in remote areas? By taking away the wireless. Of course, they're not going to be running landlines. It's just not possible. There's just way too much space involved for you to get fiber or copper out to each and every single one of those individuals. So SKA and Vox are coming up with a novel idea. They're going to be delivering connectivity via satellite. That's right, satellite communications. They'll be subsidizing satellite receiver gear from YaClick that will work with Vox satellite service to provide high-speed internet and voice communications and prices that are not too economically burdensome. Now, anyone here who uses satellite, you know that the latency is going to be horrible. You're not going to want a game here. We're talking about 800 milliseconds, even on this advanced satellite system. Some satellite systems I've used have had up to 5 millisecond latency, so this is an improvement, but you're not going to be gaming, and you're probably not going to be doing a lot of two-way communications. Forget that video conference. It's just not going to work out well. Now, they do say that these people who are using internet services in these areas probably don't have that great of service as it is, so this will be an upgrade. It may cost a little bit of money, and actually the agency may be reaching out to the general public to help subsidize the cost, which does seem kind of strange to be giving money to other people in other countries in order to provide them with internet and telephone communication. But when you consider the benefit of having the SKA, of being able to peer into those dark, deep recesses, of being able to get that kind of research material to our agencies, to our universities, to our brightest minds, well, folks, that's fantastic. Still, I find it just maybe a little bit ironic that people living in an area that could be used to bring knowledge from the furthest recesses of space are actually going to have to bounce into space to reach their neighbors. Now, when we come back, I'm going to be talking with Rob Boyd. He's a content creator, a person who I've actually been following for a while. He makes enterprise stuff. Now, if that turns you off, wait, because he's also a huge geek. You're going to want to hear what he has to say. But before that, I thought maybe now might be a good time for the tech. ¶¶ Speaking of content creators, I took a look at a device not too long ago that allowed you to take something that everybody has, namely a phone, and turn it into a fairly decent, fairly capable studio for producing on the go. So here it is. Take a look at the VE01 from MXL.
I'm Father Robert Balasair from Twit TV, and I'm taking a look at a mobile recording kit from MXL. The MMVE001 is a mobile media videographer's essentials kit from MXL, a company mostly known for its audio products. The kit itself doesn't look like much. It includes a mounting bracket, a Y cable, and the MXL FR310 shotgun microphone. The bracket starts with a clamp that can be adjusted to hold any make or model of phone. The clamp is attached to the bracket by an adjustable ball head that lets you easily adjust the position of the secured phone. A molded grip makes it easy to hold the bracket, while two cold shoes give you a mounting point for the shotgun mic and any other shoe mount accessory. On the underside of the bracket is a quarter-inch threaded receiver for using the kit with a tripod or other screw-in device. You could also remove the phone bracket and ball mount altogether to use the kit with a DSLR or small camcorder. The heart of the kit is the MXL FR310 shotgun mic. This small unit uses a 10mm electret condenser element covered by a windscreen and outputs mono sound to a 3.5mm plug. The mic has a super cardioid pickup pattern and selector switches for negative 5, 0, or plus 5 gain, and minus 6 decibel 150Hz roll-off. A single AAA battery will run the microphone for about 450 hours under typical conditions, and the entire unit sits atop a standard shoe mount. Setting up the kit takes about a minute. Clamp the phone onto the bracket, making sure not to obscure the camera. Mount the microphone in one of the shoes. Plug the Y cable into your phone. Then connect both the mic and a pair of headphones to the Y cable plugs. Calibrating the unit takes a little practice. You need to make sure that the phone is aimed on a parallel with the shotgun microphone. And unfortunately, most phones don't have a level meter. So you'll need to record a test video and play it back just to make sure everything sounds right.
It takes a little while to go ahead and get it calibrated, but once it is calibrated, it's as easy to use as your camera's phone. Now, one thing I really like is that the super cardioid pickup pattern of the mic means that it's excellent at sound rejection. Right now, I'm actually moving through the hallways of a high school in San Francisco, and even though you can pick up some of the ambient sound, most of what you hear is just my voice.
The MXL MMVE001 is available now. You can find it online for about $190. On the pro side, this kit is light and it's small. It's something that's easy enough to carry with you and then bring it out when you need to get that special shot. I also like the fact that it leverages the gear that you're already carrying with you, your phone and your headphones. The other thing I really like about it is this, the MR310 shotgun microphone. It's actually really good at rejecting sound from the back and the sides of the mic, which means that unlike when you take video with your camera phone, you're not going to get all that crap sound that tends to make your video less than professional. It isn't a professional kit per se, but it lets you get more professional shots, and I like that. On the con side, I'd say the first thing has to be this jumble of cables, the Y cable that allows you to break out the audio so you have your microphone and your headphone. The problem is that it always kind of looks like that. It's not really nice. I always end up Velcroing this to the side of the bracket. I wish that MXL had put the thought into maybe integrating that into the back of the MR310 so that I could have just less cables flopping around in the wind. The last thing has to be price. It's $190, which isn't a lot, but when you consider that you could buy the MR310 for about $130, $60 for a bracket, just really, well, that's not a good deal. If MXL were to drop the price by, say, $30 and include that Y cable, then it is a no-brainer. This is something that you should definitely go get. But because of the price, because it would actually be cheaper for you to assemble the components from MXL, buying them separately, I have to give the MXL MMVE001 a solid try. I'm Father Robert Balasair with Before You Buy.
I first took a look at that microphone at CES 2014 this past January, and I have to say, you know, it's decent. It's not something that I would use in my regular kit, but I like having it because there are times when I don't have my nice camera, when I don't have my nice audio setup, when I don't have a crew with me that I'd like to be able to just shoot something that looks decent. And the biggest part, and you know this, if you're a YouTube content creator, getting that audio just right so it doesn't have so much noise that it's just horrible to listen to, and getting the video steady so that it doesn't look like, you know, there's vertical video wanting to come out, it does add to the value of your production. And well, I like having that with me on the go. Oh, this is the time of the show that I really enjoy. It's when I get to bring a guest on. And typically, these are people who I followed for a while, or I like the content that they create. The following person is a man who is, well, he's after my own heart. You see, I do a lot of my work in the enterprise, and that's where he lives. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Rob Boyd. Rob, thank you very much for coming on to Padres Corner.
Yay. Hey, glad to be here, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I think the first time I ever met you was probably at an Interop.
I was just going
to
guess. Yep.
Yeah, way long time ago. We both go to Interop a lot. You work with Cisco. I was doing some filming inside the NOC, and you were doing filming over at the Cisco booth. And we just met and shook hands, and it was one of the sort of mutual admiration of I love the work that you were doing with Cisco, and all your production values were super high. And I was this little podcaster guy in a booth somewhere with, you know, a budget setup trying to do the same sort of thing.
Well, you know, it's funny. Okay. So I'm trying to remember when I had seen you. I remember thinking, one, that you looked familiar to me, and I couldn't figure out why, and that bugged me. But then there's a slight bit of insanity going on with everybody starting to look familiar to me now as I get older. But then there was this, you had the one man band setup, I think, at that time, or maybe I had noticed it later when you were doing that. And I go through this thing in my head, right? I'm very fortunate to get to do what I do for Cisco. We make a lot of great shows, and we've built it up over time. But that implies a certain budget and certain things that we get to do. Now it implies a different set of headaches as well. But I really respected the fact that you were out there. And until you've tried to do this on your own, and content creators know this, man, that is hard work monitoring when you're doing the shooting. Because essentially, if I remember correctly, you were doing the shooting, you were doing the lighting, you were doing the sound, and you were trying to carry the emotion and the content of the guest as well. Man, that's not easy.
Yeah, it's fun. It's different being a one man band. I mean, I have a studio behind me, and I almost forget what it's like to do the one man productions. I do it every once in a while. I do go out on the road and I'll cover an event for Twit, and I'll do it on my own. But you're right. I mean, it's something completely different, and I don't think most people are ready for that.
Well, the funny thing, so you're in a studio, and see how perfect things always go in a studio? How everything always works just the way you want it to? That's why we have studios.
Now, the people who are downloading the show aren't gonna know what's happening, but if you were watching live, you got to see.
Well, then they should be.
Yeah, no, we'll tell them now. They got to see that we had 30 minutes of Google Docs going down and me not being able to get to the show notes. And it's that sort of stuff that's annoying, but as you mentioned, if you're doing that one-man band thing, You're playing all the parts. You are host. You are producer. Yeah. You're editor. You're lighting guy. You're the gaffing guy. You're the audio guy. And I can't tell you how many times I've gotten into post-production and realized that one of those parts just wasn't right. It really just kills the shoot.
Yeah, and you got no one to blame but yourself at that point.
Exactly.
You know, but and or the time or and or anything else. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. So something else that I remember was, I believe this was at Enterprise Connect in Orlando. Were doing a big shoot with, one of the executives, a Cisco executive. And I was doing a few things with both Cisco and with HP. And you actually released your lighting guys after you were done with your shoot. And you're like, why don't you go and see if he could use some help? And I thought, it blew me away. Because I am, just a little blogger guy. Nice. I'm like, that was so nice.
I wish I could remember that time. Well, you know, it's funny. So we've built the show around trying not to work with too many executives. So sometimes if you see us with an executive, it's because we had to for kind of some marketing payola, you know, reasons on the back end, because we try to build it up. It's an engineering focused show. And that's funny. I'm so glad. You know, you never know if someone's going to bring up a story, although you're too polite to have brought it up anyway. But, you know, if I'd been I got to watch what I say, right?
It's
so nice.
You've been nothing but professional. You've been awesome. And actually, you made me appreciate very well-made content.
Thank you. Well, I don't do it alone, but
yeah.
I appreciate that I get to do it.
You've got a team, but I mean, the way that you carry the show, we'll talk about it in just a bit. In fact, right now, let's show what it is. You work with TechWise TV. So you are one of the hosts, it's a Cisco-centric. I mean, it is put out by Cisco, but the lessons that you learn at TechWise, watching TechWise TV, it is some hardcore IT. And if you've ever wanted a fundamentals course, if you've ever wanted to know how to configure an iOS switch, I don't think there's a better resource, and it's all free. That's what just blows me away.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. It's I'll wait for your questions because I get carried away talking about, well, myself, really. But, you know, the thing that makes it technical where we go for a technical audience is my co-host and our engineer, Jimmy Ray. And, if you're an engineer and hopefully you can get past this Southern accent, there is some really good content there. Some people get hung up on that. And we're a global show as well. So we go out to a lot of other places. And every now and then our Southern roots, I'm in Texas, don't go over as well, but I'm glad it's working out. So thanks for the compliments.
Let's take a step back. We've had a lot of content creators on this show, people I admire, people whose content I really, really enjoy. That's why it's so nice to talk about you. But we like to talk a little bit about what makes that person into a content creator, because in this day and age, when it is so easy for you to get out there and get your work onto the internet in front of people, it's interesting to delve into the mind of the people who do it well. Rob, I got to ask, where are you from? Where did you grow up?
So I'm a Texan. I was born in Houston, grew up in Austin, Houston, and pretty much been in Texas all my life, except for a brief stint in a separate career before I got into technology that had me up in Ohio, but always here.
A brief career before technology. Can you talk about that at all?
You're a good host. You picked up on that. Well, I know, but I wasn't leading you, but it's amazing how many people miss stuff like that. So I actually didn't start getting into technology until I turned 30, which you're thinking, gosh, Rob, that must be yesterday. It was a little bit longer than that. But my degree actually is in the services business. I'm in hotel management. So I worked for Four Seasons Hotels, and then after I'd met my wife, or we were engaged, we moved up to Ohio to open a Westin, run a Westin hotel in downtown Columbus, Ohio, renovate that property. And before I finally figured out that business was going to kill me at some point, and made a break.
Oh, when did you realize? I mean, because that kind of a career is very different from what you're doing now.
Yeah.
When did you realize that you had a passion for technology? Because you can't. One of the things about the new content creators is if you're going to do it for a long time and if you're going to get people interested in what you're broadcasting, you have to like it. Days of the dispassionate content creator are over. If you try to make content about something you care nothing about, it's going to fail. So where did your spark, your tech lust come from?
So it actually, I've always been, I think, relatively geeky, although I think the more you hang out with geeks and others, you learn that there's all new levels that I don't aspire to and couldn't get to, quite frankly. But you just gain more of an appreciation. But actually, it started with TV and video and such, where I had originally thought, coming out of high school back in the mid 80s, that I wanted to get into radio TV. Had no idea what that meant. And I was first semester at Southwest Texas State, as it was called at the time. Now I think they just call it Texas State. I took broadcast journalism. But I met a guy who was DJing at a party, and I thought DJing was cool, and got to talking to him. Turned out he hosted a radio show on the weekends. He was out of San Antonio, and this university's down in San Marcos, Texas, known at the time. I have no idea now if it is kind of a party school. Well, we went. It was at this New Year's Eve party after only having been in college one semester, and I ended up dropping out, moving into his garage and learning how to edit for him. He was a shooter, and I would edit 3/4-inch tape. He had a small AB roll type system with a 12-track Fostex multi-track for doing audio. And we did projects during the week in there, living in his garage. And then on the weekends, I would go with him into the radio station at KTSA. And so I loved that, and I thought that's where I was going to go, and I went and worked for a Fox affiliate briefly, and then I got into the hotel business and didn't look back for a long, long time. And what was wild is that when I left the hotel business, I was selling pagers. And in selling, I always felt like I had to understand how the technology worked better. I just felt closer to it. I didn't feel like I could speak to it until I could understand it a bit better. And so I was always kind of bugging the engineers, but at the time, at age 30, I'd left hotel management to become a basically a telemarketer for PageNet, if anybody remembers that company. And then from there to MCI, and then from there to a small video integrator. And then it's where I met some guys from Cisco. And so it's interesting. I don't know if it's interesting. I don't have the engineering background. I just have I just really enjoy understanding how things work. And I look back and I did some crazy stuff in terms of not understanding what I was doing when I was with MCI and some others. But Cisco has been a really good company to work for. And so it's been good so far. And I feel very fortunate too, because I've been with Cisco now 13 years. But started in sales.
I think you actually picked up on something that I think is a characteristic I see in a lot of the best geeks, and that is someone who wants to know how things work. It's one thing to know how to work a device. It's something else for someone to say, well, okay, that's how you work it, but how does it actually do that? It's that kind of curiosity. I think that's that passion that we were talking about. Still, it is kind of interesting to hear you talk about you had a career. I mean, you had a career in media. Yeah. You were doing it. By the way, let's take a little sidetrack here. The fact that you were working with the old reel-to-reels, it warms my heart, because that's where I started. We were actually just talking about this in the back room not too long ago, how when we use our editing suites, we understand what the little razor means, when we make our cuts.
Why is it a razor?
There's no people who just know that razor cuts in the timeline, but we actually grew up at a time when you had to use a razor if you wanted to splice together bits of audio or video. So yeah, that's different.
Well, you know, it's funny. So the guy I worked with, I have no idea where he is these days, and he was older than me, and it was kind of a bad scene that we were in there, because he would take in like this jug of rum, and we did this. It was an all request oldies show. And again, I'm just out of high school. So I'm first year of college and it just dropped out. So I'm sure my parents were excited about how well everything was going for me. And of course, they didn't know this detail at this point, but we'd go in and he would make rum and cokes. That was his drink, and drink all night long while we're on the air. And he brought in a duffel bag. One duffel bag was for the rum and the coke, and the other duffel bag, it was two of them, was old school, like drop whistles and horns and things like this. So it was old school, before cart machines. They may have had them then, but at least he didn't have them or didn't use them. And so he would trigger his, sound effects and everything like this. But what impressed me, because I didn't know how this worked at the time, and you mentioned the reel-to-reel, he would take calls, in from the phone lines during musical bits, and then speak to them as if they are, because we didn't have any call screener either late at night. So he'd take these calls and then he would re-edit his bits out of it, still making it sound live, all during the 3 minute, at the most music that was playing. And then he'd roll that back in smoothly when he came back out of the break again. And the way he was cutting was that quick little razor blade. He was literally splicing that tape. And I was like, ugh. That's crazy.
Yeah, every once in a while, I catch myself doing a project outside of Twit. I do a bunch of stuff for my other job, and I'm editing long projects, an hour and a half, I'll have to pull an all-nighter to get things tight. Yeah. And I'm exhausted. I'm like, oh, I hate this. And then I realize, the work that I just did 20 years ago would have took a team of 10 people a month. But because of the tech I have right now, because of nonlinear editing, because I've got basically a super professional audio booth at my disposal, I just scrub through and this one's too loose. Let's cut out 5 seconds here. Let's cut out 2 seconds there. That was unheard of when I started in audio. And I said, I had that Foscam reel to reel. I remember being really, really tired and making the wrong cut and running it through and just dying a little inside when I realize I just cut out something I need. I have to go back into the pile and find that piece of tape and put it back in. So yeah, times have changed.
I think that is destructive editing.
Destructive. Yeah. Exactly. There was no undo button.
no command Z on that one. I remember, in this rant, two old guys talking about how things, because I don't necessarily think it's better. I love new technology now, the guy that we use as our director, he's our video specialist, we call him Producer Steve, on the show, he and I differ on this, whereas I go for every upgrade that comes out. I'm like, yeah, let me try this out. I'm not really living on the alpha edge by any means. I don't like that because I need to be productive. But at the same time, I always feel like there's something better. But I remember back in that day when we were learning that stuff, you know, an argument could be made that you were much more careful and very specific about how you were going to do things because you were working in that linear fashion, and you knew you really could not go back, at least not very easily, without starting over or losing, copy generation issues with the way we were doing that, since essentially we were just doing managed copies over and over. But, you know, and so now maybe sometimes when it comes to creating content, it's so easy that we have to fight, and I bet you go through this, when you're trying to explain to someone who may not be familiar with what you do, or if you're working on something that's a break with what you've done before, you go, no, this is what I do. This is why it takes the time that it does. This is why I'm prepping the way I am, because it's all part of how I put that content together. And someone else goes, well, gosh, I've got a camera. I can go do this. Go, well, yeah, technically you could. Good luck with that.
Right. Actually, you brought up a really bad memory of when you had to make, you had your master reel, and then you made your copies, your working copies off the master reel, and you lose quality every time. And, we just take for granted now that I can edit a file that has the exact same quality, video and audio, as the first time I copied it. Okay, enough of this get off my lawn stuff. The original question I wanted to pose before we went off on this little tangent was to talk about that transition between you working in the industry and then you going into management. Was that you saying, well, this is fun, but I have to make money, I have to make a career? Or was that you just saying, I don't think this is something I can do for the rest of my life?
Are you speaking back to when I was, when I went from working in the guy's garage and then left to, you know what's funny? So it was all just kid stuff at that point. I went to work for a Fox affiliate, and this was back when, and I was what was called a tape runner. And I say this so I can hang out and be with real video guys, because at that point then I never really was in the business. And at this point I'm a wannabe technical video person, because I enjoy it as a hobby, and I enjoy the fact that I get paid essentially to be around a lot of people who are much smarter at than I do, but I have a respect for what goes into it. And so back then I was a tape runner at the time. This is in Austin, Texas. And that was when the, Arsenio Hall was on, and I think it was, the Tracy Ullman show had a little cartoon that played before it called The Simpsons. And then everybody goes, who's Tracy Ullman? And why was The Simpsons just a cartoon that ran for, what was it, a couple of minutes? But obviously that show did well. But what we would do, everything was off tape. Very few things came off satellite at that time for broadcast TV. And the tape runner's job was to load commercials for the most part. So late at night, it would be myself, and then a slightly more educated position supposedly was the switcher. And then that person would be, you know, doing the live switching and taking notes for that was required by FCC on what we did right or wrong. And then so I had these big tape machines, these big, huge cartridges that we'd load up, and then they would fail. But so what really leaving that was more about just making money. I went back. I had, you know, felt this subtle or not so subtle pressure from my parents to get back in gear, get back into school. And that didn't pay much at all working at Fox. And so I took a job washing dishes and at a motel, and it was surprising how much I just enjoyed the service business. And so I kind of worked my way up from there at various motels, hotels, then decided to go back to school, major in that, which took me back to the University of Houston, and finished up there with a hotel degree. But yeah, it was probably money motivated and just this subtle, hey, you've got to have to be a contributing member of society at some point.
Okay, so if it was a money move, and I understand that, and I respect that, and
much money, though, let me tell you. Survival money.
Survival money, right. At some point, everyone gets to that point in their lives where they realize, I may not love this, but it's going to keep me fed. It's going to keep a roof over my head.
Well, I didn't know any better. I loved it then. I mean, because I didn't know I could do this, for instance. I have no idea how to tell someone how to get the job I do now.
Well, then how did you make that transition? Because you went from working in the garage and hanging out with media people to doing a job that was going to make you money, and then you get back in the media. How did that transition happen?
Yeah, I was when I left Weston, I was director of rooms, which is an executive position, but the hotel, I don't know if it's a secret or not. You don't get paid much in senior management in the hotel business. And you look nice, you have to wear these nice suits, but you're just bleary-eyed because of the long hours. And I was always in something, I seemed to always be in a position of being over the services in a hotel that ran 24 hours a day. So if you didn't have really good staff, then there was just always something that was bringing you in at any time of the night, or a special group. And this hotel we had in Ohio had a great a grand ballroom that was real popular for weddings. And so we turned from corporate traffic into a pretty good traffic on the weekends. But we were being renovated and going all through this. And I was just tearing my hair out. And honestly, it was there was a little bit of a money motivation and leaving at the time and a bit of a sanity. So I was newly married and I was a stress monster in that thing because the long hours, didn't think much about the low pay because I didn't really think of it as low pay then because I just didn't know any better. And my wife had got a job, my new wife had got a job selling cellular phones. And this was back, you know, it's still, you still see it now, but it's when these, it kind of the growth of cellular phones when these reseller companies would you know, resell for the networks and you could make good money. And she was a fearless cold caller and this kind of thing. And all of a sudden I saw her income doubling mine, but I was the official manager, you know, with a highfalutin supposedly position. And she was bringing in some good money. And I was like, well, this is kind of good. And she wasn't working near the hours I was. And so out of stress, I finally made the move through a friend of a friend with a promise that I'd move into outside sales if I took a this telemarketing job. And that began the, hey, this is a lot of fun. It's a little bit more normal hours, not so service driven. It was a bit more under control. And then I got a chance to start learning some stuff, hanging out with smart technical people and you know, and seeing how we began to solve problems with technology, which I really began to enjoy.
Nice. Very nice. And then you go from there to directly to Cisco and TechWise, or were there a couple of intermediary steps?
No, there was a couple. It was from PageNet to MCI, and then from MCI to MCI helped me move back to Dallas from Ohio, and this is before they imploded, and then they and then a small video conferencing integrator. So at MCI, I was a conferencing specialist where we essentially tried to drive more minutes on the service for audio and really not much video conferencing. So primary audio conferencing. And then I'm working for a video integrator in Dallas that was trying to grow their business with Cisco doing video over IP. And it was in that process I met some guys at Cisco and it just looked like they were, you know, they made good money, having a good time, had a lot of respect in the market. And got over to that, and that was about 2000. And so I moved over to Cisco in sales, and that was right before the bottom all dropped out. So I just missed. I had moved over to Cisco just before everything all went to heck in the business, and which was actually good, though, because that meant I never really experienced the unrealistic heyday. And I actually became a security specialist, which made no sense at the time, but I did really well with it. And it was, you know, every now and then Cisco would take sales and engineering and create, depending on what market they were going into, they would either hire or create specialists. We were called product sales specialists at the time. And so I became a security specialist and then worked on our channels organization. It was actually through presenting and doing stage presenting and things to cover the large market that I was in that I was kind of recognized as having some aptitude for the ability to tell stories, I guess. And there was this idea to create a show called TechWise TV, as it turns out. But at the time, I had my own show. Jimmy Ray Purser, my engineer, he had his own show doing routing and switching. We were kind of our silos, and there was another person with us. She was doing a collaboration-oriented shows. It was just kind of half an idea that marketing people come up with. And so we transitioned. I'd already been at Cisco for 5 or so years, and then we took that show in like 6 months of runway is about probably all the budget had, and figured out how to kind of keep it going through various means. You're showing the preview to one of our shows. And so we slowly began to build it up to where over time we've built our own production teams to kind of lower our cost. We've tried to always remain true to, you know, it's no secret we work for Cisco, so you expect us to be homers for Cisco. But at the same time, hopefully we don't beat your head up over it, you know, because there are times, and we're technically a function of marketing, and that's certainly where we get paid for, but we try to give honest advice, and if we're asked to do something that we truly don't agree with, then we'll actually try to not do that kind of content. We'll of course never lie about it, but rather than not say something truth, not that we ever asked you. What's the right way to put that, Robert? Not a lack of truthfulness, but a respect for the fact that our audience is intelligent and would see right through the fact that we're trying to fill them with marketing fluff, and all Cisco did was change the name of something to something else that's actually old in the industry. We just try to avoid those or be allowed to call them out. And we've been fortunate enough to be able to keep doing that.
That's actually an incredible line that you walk. And I will admit, the very first time I heard about TechWise TV, before I had ever watched it, I thought, Oh, okay. So it's Cisco's in-house PR group, and they turn out videos to push Cisco product.
And they still do. There is a lot of videos. I think someone said in the chat room, and you're right. Oh my gosh, if you ever subscribed to the just the YouTube channel, that's not even where they all go.
Right.
You'll get six a day, and you know, and that's not us. That's Cisco at large.
But
they're doing their job in some way, I guess.
I had conflated them, so I thought, oh, okay, so TechWise TV is they're just going to tell me everything I need to buy more Cisco stuff. I started watching the content, and I was impressed. There's obviously knowledge there. There's obviously access to really nice high-end equipment. And more than that, there was a presentation of topics, of technologies that went beyond Cisco. And I always wondered, how do you get away with that? Because I'm sure there's got to be a voice screaming in your ear saying, oh, well, you know, we really want to push this, or this new product is out, or we would really like you to phrase it this way so that people go towards this direction. How do you deconflict a educational channel that is owned by a company that wants to sell its product?
Well, it's a every show kind of battle, and I think you're probably crediting us, and thank you for that, for being better at that than I think we are. Essentially, on a show by show basis, as we examine it, we don't have to take every topic, because we're not, we don't have to do every topic. We choose what we're going to cover. We propose a lot of the stuff that we're going to cover, but there has to be budget found for it. There's always a reality that good production costs, and we think it's a very reasonable cost for the balance that we strike. And then when we write that content, you know, what's nice about the longevity, we've been doing this for 7 years or 8 years now. And one of the things that's come out of that, because we have other shows that we do too, but they don't have the longevity. And one of the hardest things about doing it is you're really not allowed to have your own voice sometimes in the situations where it's not been established. But then once you've established it, we're just fortunate to have held to it so that we can then say, well, that's not our style. Or thankfully, in some situations, we've done it enough times, maybe with similar groups or with people that are just kind of repeat stakeholders, so to speak, within Cisco, that they're already helping us pre-decide, which is a benefit and a curse, because we also don't want to overlook an opportunity. We're looking, and every show should have a mix of, there's always a marketing element. And what we found is that if you really go for the educational side, which is a requirement of every show, and say, what is it someone's going to learn either about the industry at large, about Cisco, or about just doing something better or smarter, we want that as a required element. The marketing always works its way back in. And sometimes it's because of the theme. Sometimes it's direct because we're doing it because it's a launch show and there is new product that we need to launch. But we're going to pick what we cover from that and try to be honest about, Why is it? That sounds horrible to say. Try to come across as being, picking out things that will hopefully be a benefit to the audience.
Well, I think you do a pretty good job. I mean, be difficult to talk about networking in general when you work for the company that still owns the lion's share of the market of networking. You want to try to stay neutral. You want to try to stay on the educational side. But, you can't help but talk about your company's gear.
Thank you.
I'd like to pick your brain on a couple of stories. I don't get to do this a lot with my guests because we spend most of the time reminiscing about the old days when I was using floppy disks and degaussing things. But as a fellow geek, there are a couple of stories that I'd love to throw your way and see if maybe we could chit chat about them. How does that feel to you?
You got it. Let me know. I hope I've been so buried in writing for upcoming shows. I hope I know something about what you're talking about, but give me a shot.
Well, this first one it's been around for a while, and it's actually been personally distressing to me, considering everything that's happening in the broadband industry at the moment. Right now, Comcast is getting sued, and specifically they're getting sued for their new Xfinity Wi-Fi service. I don't know if you've heard about this, but essentially it means that if you got one of those combo router / Wi-Fi access point things from Comcast, they've been turning them on and creating a nationwide, or at least Comcast service nationwide, Wi-Fi service that any Comcast customer can use. It sounds like a great idea, except for one thing, which is it's using customers' modems. they can't actually turn it off unless you call Comcast. Now, they say it's not going to affect your data cap. It's not going to affect your security because everything is VLAN off, and we understand that the tech behind that. But the lawsuit is essentially saying, okay, put aside the fact that you're using the connection that I paid for. Mm-hmm. You cannot deploy a nationwide or Comcast nationwide network with me paying for the electricity if you're not going to give me any benefit for this. And that's what this lawsuit's about. We've got two people in San Francisco who have kicked off a class action against Comcast and Comcast's 150,000 Xfinity router Wi-Fi units that are currently broadcasting free Wi-Fi to everybody. Now, as a geek, it's a cool idea. I kind of like this. This whole idea of I could access a Wi-Fi access point that's VLAN so that I get a bit of security. But as a consumer, I'm thinking, yeah, you know, Comcast screws me in so many different ways. I don't want to be their hotspot. I don't want to be the resource that they use to create a network that they're going to charge me for. What are your thoughts?
This is going to sound so first I got to say, of course, I'm not representing Cisco with anything I say here. To make sure I understand it correct, because I'm not that familiar with it. Are they basically, so in the same way that I've got my router, like I use a Fios service, then this is creating an open, I've got my Wi-Fi potentially off this, which that's not how I do it. But let's say that I'm using their Wi-Fi on their router, and it's also creating a separate Wi-Fi network that anybody within range, which of course is relatively limited, could be piggybacking on.
Exactly.
As part of a service, so it's
If I've got one of their combo routers, what I do is I have the part of the router that I can access. So if I log in, I can create all my settings. I name my SSID, I do my WPA2 key, et cetera, all that normal stuff. There's a separate wireless network that I cannot turn off without calling. There is no interface for me to log into, so I have to call Comcast, and I've done it twice. It is an absolute pain, and it didn't actually work. They didn't actually turn it off. They turned it off, and then they turned it back on. It creates a Wi-Fi hotspot called Xfinity XXX.
Oh, so you can see the SSID broadcasting.
You can see it, right. So exactly, okay. That's the thing. Like, I can see I can see two SSIDs coming out of my device. That SSID can now be accessed by other Comcast customers who pay an additional fee to access the Xfinity Wi-Fi network.
So like your neighbor, like you could be paying because you've got the cable, and then your neighbor could be getting a reduced rate just being close enough to you. oh my God. Well, so the first problem I have with it is, first of all, that it's awfully presumptuous. And there's an assumption there that they're handling the security just fine, which is always a huge assumption. Because most users don't even do a very good job with that. I can't, you know, granted they're taking it out of the user's hands, but there's still a whole big, trust me, you know, we've got this handled. Don't you worry about this. And so I don't like the notion that it's coming through. It's like, I was trying to think of something similar. It's like if I have we just built a house here in Dallas, and let's say that for whatever reason, the builder forced me to include an extra bathroom that faced outward on the house. And so I'm like, and every day I'm reminded when I see people using this bathroom that's connected to my house, but it's a different door and it's secure, you know. But I don't like the fact I can hear it flushing and it's using my water, and possibly electricity. I don't know. I can't even imagine that is that big of a business. Is it something that's usually in, I live in suburbia, so there's not that many people that would be able to reach my Wi-Fi anyway if it's floating out there. But is this something just to help them lay a few less cables in congested areas?
To me, it sounds as if Comcast would really like to be able to say that they have a wireless network. And if they had the ability to just turn on 150,000 hotspots just immediately, and they didn't have to run any extra infrastructure other than getting to their customers' homes, it does give them the ability to say, hey, look, we've got a nationwide network. You could now have this phone, your iPhone, and never have to use the cell service. You just go from Xfinity hotspot to Xfinity hotspot. Think of all the places where Comcast is deployed. Yeah.
Well, that's coming too. We're seeing so much offload onto, potential offload into the Wi-Fi network as speeds go up, and we say this is going to be, this terrestrial type of connectivity is going to help us get bandwidth faster than it is in deploying more cell towers. I don't know. Yeah, it seems, it also reminds me when you were saying it then of like newspapers that would, you know, that are going to that basically that are able to charge advertisers based on their distribution. And so they could say, because they hand out copies of their paper at so many different places, that they have a certain amount of eyeballs that they're reaching. You know, is there something in the background that helps them from that perspective? I don't know.
Yeah. And the other part for me, again, as a tech nerd and an IT guy, is I don't like the idea that there's just another Wi-Fi hotspot that's broadcasting in my airspace. I really don't. I mean, I control all the Wi-Fi access points in the campuses that I set up. This idea that someone is just going to come in and turn on another Wi-Fi hotspot that I have absolutely no control over, and yet it is inside the walls of my building, it rubs me the wrong way. But
there's only so many channels you have to play with, too. Yeah,
I mean, because, yeah, they're all broadcasting on the 2.4 gigahertz spectrum. So, you know, they're not even playing with 5.8 gigahertz. And the other issue, and this, you know, it sounds silly. The study was saying that the activation of the Xfinity Wi-Fi hotspot could increase power consumption by up to 40%. The numbers actually look a little fishy to me. I don't think that's quite right. But still, even if it's 1% or 2%, the fact that 1% or 2% is being charged, effectively charged to consumers who are already paying for the service, and they're getting no compensation for essentially being a hotspot for Comcast, I think the class action might actually have legs.
Well, there you hit it too. I mean, if I think it'd be a different matter if we were given that option to subsidize our connectivity a little bit by being able to do that, and especially if I could get a free code for getting my neighbors to sign up for it, you know, and possibly subsidize my connection. I mean, I'm not interested in doing that, but I could see where someone might be.
Yeah. Or even if they said, hey, you know what, if you allow us to turn this on, we're going to take $2 off your monthly bill. Most people would be okay with that. Most people would do the calculus and say, sure. Yeah, no problem. But the fact that Comcast is just going to assume that because it's their box and their wire that they can turn this on and use your electricity. No. No.
It's a big company. Yeah.
Get off my lawn.
A bit presumptive. Yeah, get off my lawn.
Just a bit. Let's move on to something else. This has been making the rounds. And again, coming from Cisco, I'd love to hear your IT background brain on this.
Personal opinion.
Specifically, the Sony breach. So we've talked a lot about the Sony breach in the last week and a half. It's pretty horrible. The more information we hear about the breach, the worse it gets. We were used to having the Home Depot hack being the worst thing ever and the Target hack being the worst thing ever. Now we hear about the Sony hack, and just the things that we know are frightening. About 100 terabytes worth of data were sucked out of this network. The malware that was used actually hard-coded 50 servers from Sony's internal network, pointing to the fact that either it's an inside person or people who had intimate knowledge of how the Sony network worked. We know that it was hacked by a group that calls itself the Guardians of Peace. There are some rumors that it's associated with North Korea, but that doesn't really matter. What matters is that this is the Pearl Harbor of the advanced persistent threat. And the advanced persistent threat means one thing for IT people, and that is the death of perimeter security. Now, it's still important, but now there's this thing going in the IT community saying you just have to assume. It's no longer presumptuous to say that you've been hacked, but you have to assume that you've been hacked. You have something running in your network right now that is trying to get access to data it shouldn't have. And it changes the way that we run IT. Have you covered any of that at all? This idea of looking at exfiltration rather than infiltration.
Oh yeah, no, we've actually covered it a lot of different ways. Cisco's made a lot of different moves in security over time, and you do have to. I think that's exactly the right attitude you have to have, which is not when will you get hacked, but it's whether or not you'd really be aware of it. I think the thing that scares me the most about most of the breaches that we've seen is that there becomes this realization and new news over time that says, well, it occurred then. And then you find out, oh no, it occurred much earlier. And then, you know what? We're not really sure when it occurred. And you go, you know, and in some of these situations, these are companies that are certified and, you know, would pass the letter of law from a policy and government oversight perspective, you know, because they're managing cardholder data or something like that. And the biggest thing I think these days is really, yes, you've got to, you know, make all the right moves to put up as best you can define a perimeter, put that up. But at the same time, you've got to be inspecting things and looking for anomalous behavior and really base things not on known threats, because everything's moving too fast for that. And really say, well, what's anomalous? What's happening different from my pattern? And I don't say cross your fingers, but you got to put that kind of stuff in place and just go in with the assumption, think like a criminal, where these type of things would happen and assume that they're going to be there.
Yeah. So one of the products that we took a look at on a few of our shows here on the Twit TV network is a startup called IDIS. And we know the engineers because they used to work for Dell, and we've had them on our enterprise show, This Week in Enterprise Tech. And their product is interesting because it does the standard firewall stuff. It looks at signatures. It looks at attacks that are coming in. But the biggest selling point for me was that it looked at data going out of the network. And it looked at known protocols and did deep packet inspection in the known protocol. So it wasn't just going to assume that because something was on port 21 that it really was FTP. It's not going to assume that something really was just a DNS request. It's actually going to look and say, wait a minute, why is all this clear text leaking out over DNS requests?
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of security that we're headed to. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure Cisco is working on this too, in these new generation of firewalls, which is, yeah, try to stop them at the perimeter, but assume they're inside and keep them from sending out anything that's sensitive.
Yeah, what you're looking for there is obviously because a lot of times you're looking for command and control type activity. You're looking for communication that's occurring to a known bad source or something that deviates from the norms. We talked about kind of that anomalous activity, because you got to know what's normal for your network so that you can know when something is different. But here's the golden rule in security is that, and this is the fun about being in it for something, is it will always change because it's the nature of the beast, in that it's always going to be somewhat reactive. You know, we're going to do everything we can to proactively if we say the white hats are going to proactively do everything they can to try and figure out how to stop something, but it's all guesswork. It's not until something actually happens that's new and different, and those are the only ones that make the news, that you begin to realize, oh, we didn't think about possibly doing that. You know, some of these retailer breaches, you dig into those details, and I don't go to them as far as some of my counterparts do, but, you know, in general, what we were seeing is attackers that take their time. Because, you know, the difference between a targeted attack and kind of a broad-based, let me see what I can find type attack are completely different. Because if someone targets you and they've got the time, the patience, potentially the funding, depending on where they're coming from, that's going to happen. They're going to get in. And, you know, the thing then becomes, do you even realize it? Because what we are seeing in some of these breaches is where the attacks are happening very slow over time, low and slow. And they're even happening, they're designed to where some of the some of the automated programs that are being installed are designed to look at network time for the local time that they're in, run at off times, disguise themselves using protocols that will either resemble backup traffic or make sure that they're only sending small amounts of information in a certain form that's going to help it kind of mask itself in the noise of other stuff that's expected to happen on that network. And you start thinking about the level of intelligence that goes into those things, and it scares the bejeebers out of you, because you're like, yeah, you know, that would get past me, you know, and so I never hold myself out as being the smart guy that's going to be able to defeat anybody by any means, because that's nothing could be further from the truth, you know.
I've had a security guru, Raphael Mudge, on a couple of my shows, and every time that man comes on, he scares the absolute living daylights out of me. I mean, he's shown me attacks, pivots, browser pivots. He's shown me obfuscation of command and control. He did this. It's a custom module that essentially allows malware to lie in wait within a network to spread itself and have absolutely zero footprint until he needs it. And he's a good guy. So he shows people how he does it. But I'm thinking, if he's showing me how he does it, there's at least a dozen people who aren't, and their attacks are going unnoticed. And
it's a community. It's a, you know, these. And the good guys have to act like bad guys. You have to. That's a normal way of doing business, because you have to think like that. But they're staying up late. They're exchanging information with each other. You know, we've talked in the past about honeypots and such like that, where, you know, we will, you know, trap information to kind of see what are people using. Because what's funny though, as much as we love to talk about the new stuff, old style attacks, that you'd think should be long gone are still extremely useful.
Long live the DDoS. The DDoS is still around.
And that's still one of the hard ones to get around, too. I mean, it just makes sense, right?
Well, like DDoS, especially with NTP or DNS amplification, it's devastating. I remember when I used to hire out I remember when people used to have to hire out a botnet several thousand strong in order to knock a server off the web. Now, if I have a 1 megabit connection and I use DNS amplification, I can generate 40 gigabits of traffic without sweating. And that's just, it's amazing. I mean, and it's not that hard to do. Just a script kiddie could do it.
No, and that's, and you can pay for that service now, right? So if you're just a bitter non-geek, then you just simply farm those services out. You get something like that going from, and they base it, right? The price is based on, well, how many zombied machines do you want to send an attack in a certain direction? And because it's coming from so many directions, you can't sort out the legitimate traffic from the nefarious traffic. And so that business is down for the count, more than likely, unless they've got a whole lot of pipe and the ability to work with their service provider to kind of reroute it.
Rob, I want to thank you for being part of this episode of Padres Corner. We've actually used up our entire hour. This has been an absolute pleasure to sit with a fellow enterprise geek and to talk to a fellow content creator. And again, you know, thank you very much for reaching out to that little blogger guy that was sitting in the corner, because this is so much fun. And I'm so happy that I'm doing it. I'm so happy that you're doing it, too. If you could please tell the Twit audience, our Twit army, where they can find you. I mean, of course, they're going to want to go to TechWise TV. They're going to want to check out your content and see maybe if they might be interested in learning how to put together the next generation data center. But where else might they find you and your content?
Yeah, all the new shows and the workshops and such that we do go on that website that's only really been running for the last year. That's TechWiseTV.com. My personal website is robboyd.com, R-O-B-B-B-O-Y-D. That's three B's in a row. You got to get all of them in there, which is also my Twitter handle. I try to do a good job of getting that stuff out. Although specific to the show, I have people that help me with that one. So we try to put something out. And the Twitter account for the show is TechWise TV, at TechWise TV. That's probably your best bet for trying to keep up with those things there. And I hope if anybody's watching that you follow us, let us know what kind of content, where are we getting it right, where are we getting it wrong? What kind of stuff do we need to move forward on in the future? Is there stuff that we've not been covering that people would like to see? Very, very handy, and appreciate the feedback as always.
Rob, an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us, and I'll chat with you on the internets.
Please do, man. Take care. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Take care.
Take care.
Folks, I also want to thank you. I know that this is a late show. I know that this show is kind of esoteric. We go through a lot of different topics, a lot of different types of guests. And the fact that you come back week after week, you download our show, it means a lot to me. It means that I do get to create content that I really enjoy. That's what Padres Corner was all about. I mean, yeah, we've got shows that cover pretty much every topic of tech under the sun. Padres Corner is just a chance for us to let our hair down and see what else there might be. Don't forget that you can find every episode of Padres Corner at our show page at twit.tv/padre. If you go there, you'll find all of our notes. You want to find out a little bit more about one of the stories that I talked about at the top of the show. You want to find out about one of our guests, or if you want to subscribe so that you get every episode of Padres Corner automatically on your device of choice, that's where you're going to want to go, twit.tv/padre. Also, don't forget that you can always subscribe to me on Twitter. If you find me at twitter.com/PadresJ, you'll find out what I'm going to be doing for every episode of Padres Corner. And you'll also find out what happens when I'm not on Twit TV. You can find me flying my quadcopters a lot or making fun of people with bed bugs. It's just a sort of a geek's snapshot of what the world might look like. Also, don't forget that you can find me here on the Twit TV network multiple times during the week. On Mondays, you'll find me for This Week in Enterprise Tech at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time, where I get to talk about data centers, switches, pretty much everything that connects the world. On Tuesdays, you'll find me for Padres Corner at 7:30 p.m. Usually, you'll also find me on Before You Buy at 3 o'clock, where I'll show you some of the gear that I've been playing with. And then on Thursday, you'll find me twice, once at 11 o'clock with Brian Burnett, for Know How, where I'll go over some of the projects that we've been geeking out over and maybe give you something that you want to build over a weekend. And then at 1:30, it's Coding 101. If you've ever wanted to know a little bit about something the people do when they code, when they become code monkeys and code warriors, you're going to want to check me out 1:30. all time specific, and always at live.twit.tv. I also want to thank everyone here at the Brick House who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo for letting me keep the lights on, to Zach, my super editor, and of course, to Brian Burnett for getting off the TD desk when he needs to so that I can get on and do my thing. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballas here.